wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
And for Dear Science this week, we are joined once again by our expert, Dr. Krishna McGovern. Good afternoon.
Kia ora.
And we've got lots of science planned for today, starting with a name I struggled to pronounce. Did I get it quite right?
Yeah, no, you did quite well.
Denisovan?
Denisovan, yeah.
Yeah, and I'd never heard of these before. Early human subspecies, but one of the less discussed ones.
Yeah, because there's not really a lot of fossil evidence for it, right? And it's quite a fascinating story. So we're starting off with the dragon man skull, which was this skull itself. It's got quite a massive cranium, and it's got quite an interesting story in itself. And it's a recent study's come out that kind of indicates that this skull actually is Denisovian. So if we go back to the dragon man skull, and the story is that in 1933, it was discovered by a labourer in working on a bridge building project in Harbin in China for a Japanese-aligned railway project. So 1933, not all's great in the world. And a few years earlier, a fossil called the Peking Man had been found, and it had created a lot of media and stuff. And so the story is that he recognised that this was significant, and so he hid it away from the authorities in this abandoned well. Then 1945, the war ended, the Japanese occupation ended, but he wanted to hide his links with the Japanese imperialists, so he didn't report the skull.
He's leaving it even further.
Yeah, right. He's left it there. And so, as the story goes, up until, 2018, then he told his grandkids about it, and one grandson went and found this. And then somehow someone at the university must have heard about it, like that bit of the story is not very clear, and this grandson was persuaded to donate it to the Harbin Geo University, where it's since lived.
Yeah.
And so what these, so people who study early humans are called paleoanthropologists, and there was this group at this Harbin Geo University who studied the skull. Now, because it's got this bit of this history, this story, they didn't find it, so they weren't really absolutely sure where it came from.
Yeah, not quite verifiable.
Exactly, right? So what they first did was they went to this area and they found some other mammal fossils. And so they've used these mammal fossils in the skull, and they've basically tested the elemental distribution, so what sort of, you know, has it got copper, lead, these sorts of things. Looked at rare earth elements and their concentrations and stable isotopes. And it's basically to a chemical fingerprint, right? And so they want to compare these and are they similar?
Yeah,
they
don't verify the location.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And everything was consistent. Yeah, it kind of came from this area. And then they've used uranium dating to figure out how old it is and found out it's about 146,000 years ago that it was, this being was alive.
Yeah.
And so then they studied its morphology, like the shape of the skull and everything, and they decided, okay, we have a new early hominin, so an early human, and they called it Homo longi, and this was in 2021. And then some of the stuff I read, there was a bit of controversy around it because it is just one skull and everything.
Yeah,
but
not like conclusive evidence for a whole group, right?
Yeah. And so that's where, so that's kind of where we get to the story of the dragon man at that point. It actually turns out that one of the authors of that paper, who was one of the paleoanthropologists who studied this, he doesn't really believe the grandson's story of how this fossil was found.
Yeah.
He actually thinks the grandson found it, didn't tell the authorities, but then it's kind of got found out anyway, so then kind of fabricated the story.
Some family drama.
So I find that quite fascinating, you know. It's a human element to the story of humans. Right, so we've got this skull. So now we're going to flip to another thread of the story where we go back to 2008 and we're in Russia, of all places, in Serbia, and we've got a group of Russian archaeologists looking in this cave called the Denisova Cave.
Yeah.
Name That's, rings a bell,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I've heard that name before.
It's a Russian, it's definitely a very Russian Slavic name.
Right, yeah. And so these cave systems were quite known for being a good source of early human artifacts and stuff like this. And what they found was just a really small finger bone, which they were then, another group was able to actually sequence a mitochondrial DNA from it and figure out that it was a juvenile female and that it belonged to this new subpopulation of early humans called Denisovans.
Wow.
And so that was just this one little finger bone.
Just this one finger bone. And we found a whole subspecies off of it. Now, I'm guessing we've got a link between these two cases.
Yes, we do, right? So we're getting there. So since then, I think that I've found that there have been seven more instances of these Denisovans, but we really don't know much about them. And so that one of these researchers that was involved with this ancient DNA study on this finger bone got permission to look at the dragon melon skull. And so, obviously, she was determined to try and find some DNA. So she looked in the teeth and some really dense bone that's just by your inner ear, because this is hard material, so DNA could survive. And she found nothing. No DNA material. Okay, what's next? Okay, well, let's look at the proteins, because proteins are a bit hardier than DNA. They might survive a bit better. DNA codes for proteins, so proteins might give us some genetic information. And she was able to, well, she and her group, obviously it's not one person doing all this work, found 95 proteins, and four of those types of proteins were known to differ between Denisovans and other hominins based on these other fossils they'd found. And three of these proteins had variants that were the same as Denisovans. So it's kind of some evidence to...
Yeah, some similarities there.
Exactly. But she really wanted DNA.
Yeah, some conclusive evidence. Yeah, okay.
So one last try. So she went, the group went and looked at dental plaque on the remaining tooth.
Wow.
So if you've ever not gone to the dentist for a while, right, and then you've got to get your teeth cleaned and it's quite painful, right, because the plaques, they'll try to get that all off. It's really hard stuff. Like, it sticks there. But it's full of bacterial DNA. Not so often that it's the human DNA in there. But so looked at it and actually managed to find some human DNA that was of the right age, because of course the DNA that they're interested in needs to be old. It needs to be
the same from the same time period.
Exactly, right? Because you think about it, this skull has been picked up and handled by a bunch of people who probably weren't thinking about DNA profiling or
especially
this thing
back then, right?
Yeah. Exactly. And so there was a lot of contamination with just human DNA that they have ways of saying that it's seeing that it's more modern. And so of the DNA that they were in, okay, this is ancient DNA, there were 27 gene variants they were able to identify, seven of which actually matched the seven known Denisovans. So they've taken this as pretty good evidence that this is an example of Denisovan. So now we know what they kind of looked like. They had wide faces, they had prominent brow ridges that we commonly associate with early hominins or early human subspecies, but delicate cheekbones, which are more modern traits. And now we know that they actually had a much wider range than we initially thought.
Very interesting stuff. And this next story, plants, roots, there's two? I don't even understand what's going on here, right?
Yeah, no, it was quite a eye-catching headline and a really good pun about we have a shallow understanding of how much we know about plant roots. So a traditional theory of plant roots and how I thought about them was you have the plant grows above the ground, it puts its roots down. As you go deeper, you're just going to get less and less roots, right?
Yeah.
And so this is a pretty common traditional sort of way of looking at it. And what this study did was they actually had access to 44 sites around the world across different climate zones and ecological niches, so from like tundra to rainforest. And they actually had soil that went down 1.8 metres, which is the key. And so what they did was they basically would take sections with depth and then look at how much root mass was in them. And so you could basically get a depth profile of how much plant root was in that depth. And for 20% of the sites that they were looking at, what they actually found was, you'd get a lot of root mass closer to the surface, but then you went deeper down, like below a metre, and there'd suddenly be another
clump. Yeah,
exactly.
Interesting.
Right? And so it's this idea that, the plants, like one in five plants are kind of putting down the second sort of set of roots that are much deeper so they can get to, nitrogen-rich soil and stuff. And so the idea is that probably most of their resources are coming from the surface, but if they need to, then they can tap in.
Might be able to escape, plants will be taking their nutrients from the more shallow soil so they can get down to the less tapped stuff.
And then it's also, it has implications for climate modelling and how we use carbon. Soil as a carbon storage and such. But it was a little bit like plants, right?
I mean, you'd think we'd have solved plants by now, right?
Yeah, and there was a comment from a researcher who did actually mention that this isn't a new idea. It's just kind of the first time that the data or the samples have been there for use to study.
Yeah, and then this last story, sea spider farming.
Okay, so
yeah.
I realise as you said it earlier, my title was a little bit misleading. So these are sea spiders that farm.
Right. Okay.
Not us farming them.
What are they farming?
The bacteria on their backs.
Bacteria. Yeah. Sorry, I had to. Oh, God.
So in the Earth's ocean, you'll get sites that are called methane seeps, and it's basically a break in the Earth's crust where you get methane bubbling up. Mm. And around these areas, you'll get basically microbial ecosystems, and these are microbes that can use the methane as their food source. And so what you do find a lot of life around these. So, they've found mussels, worms, and sponges at these sites. And basically what these things do is they eat the chemosynthetic bacteria. So chemosynthetic just meaning that these are bacteria that use a chemical to eat, like sort of methane. And they're using that methane that's coming up through the Earth's crust as their food source. But what they noticed in these areas is there's lots and lots and lots of sea spiders. And they're like, well, okay, the sea spider, there's too many for them to be just eating the mussels and the worms, and like their gut doesn't really imply that they're preying on them. So what the heck are they eating?
Yeah, it's like when you see a large population of humans in a place and you're like, oh, what are all these people eating?
Right, yeah, exactly. And so they're kind of like, okay, let's investigate. So they had access to remote operated vehicles of the submersible kinds, and then they also had Alvin submersibles, which are the ones people go down in, and they were able to collect up some sea spiders and bring them up to their research vessel without killing them. So, you've got to play with pressure and all this. Not as easy as just bringing them back up. And so what they did first was they basically mapped the bacteria that are on the exoskeleton of the spider, on its back. And so they use things like what's called metagenomic sequencing. So this is just looking at DNA and RNA all together and sequencing it. Something else called 16S RNA, ribosomal RNA sequencing, which is it's more specific to the bacteria, and then another method called fluorescence in situ hybridization, again specific to the bacteria. So they just want to see what types of bacteria there. And so there's a bunch of different types, but what they found was that three families were the majority, and these families were methentrophic and methyltrophic. So what all that means is that those bacteria either use methane as a carbon source, they basically their food source, or methyls, which are just molecules that have one carbon. So that's methane, methanol, those sort of things.
Right. So similar food sources.
Exactly. And so there's all these bacteria on there. Then they also used electron and nanoscale imaging to look at the exoskeleton surface a bit more. And what they found was that they were kind of like, they described them as volcano-shaped clumps of these bacteria that were basically embedded in extra polymeric substance. So this just means it was a biofilm, right? Those bacteria were sticking to the back. Yeah. They weren't just falling off. So, okay, so there's all these bacteria on these sea spiders. Who cares? What's going on?
Yeah.
So because they managed to keep them alive and had them on the ship, what they were able to do was obviously feed them.
Yeah.
So they gave them methane in one experiment or methanol in another experiment. But what they did is they replaced the carbon from being carbon-12 to carbon-13. So it's heavy carbon. It's an isotope of carbon that's not very common in nature. So what you can do is you can basically track it, right? Mm. And so you feed this into the system where the sea spiders are that have the bacteria on their back. Leave it for 5 days and see what happens.
Follow it around. Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. How do they feed them? I was going to say, I'm just imagining them sprinkling it in like fish food. Or do they gas?
It's probably just some gas. Pumped through the water kind of thing. I didn't actually read it, but I imagine it's kind of like mimicking the actual methane seep where you're just having the methane gas bubbling up into the water.
Interesting.
Then they tested the bacteria and the extra polymeric substance layer on the spiders and found it was carbon rich. C13, so this heavy carbon. They looked at the chitin, which is the exoskeleton material on the spider. It wasn't heavy carbon rich, but the epithelium or the cells in the gut of the spider were heavy carbon rich. So, these spiders had to be getting this heavy carbon into them from the bacteria, right? And then with their imaging, what they'd actually seen was there were some areas that looked like they'd been scraped, right? So the spiders basically toddles along, but hungry, scrape her back.
Got a feed. I'm just like a food stash.
I just had to Google
them
right now because I've never actually heard of sea spiders. And
I hadn't either.
Wow, they're... Oh, I would not like to be swimming or diving and seeing one of those.
Yeah, not something an arachnophobe should probably be looking up before bedtime kind of thing.
Yeah, that's incredible, right? It's like bringing along a little food stash with you. I mean, everyone can relate to that sort of. And now we're imagining, you know, these guys are creating the farm themselves.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
That's pretty cool.
Actually, yeah, they've got quite long legs. No wonder they can just reach over and scratch their backs.
Yeah. Wow. All right. Well, thank you for sharing these science stories with us. This prehistoric type of human, these plant roots and sea spiders making their own farms. I mean, this is amazing stuff that you can only catch here on Dear Science, the pinnacle of science news. All right. Thank you, Kushla, for coming in this week. Thank you, Moshet. And thank you, Science. We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the B.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.